This week, after an operatic programme today, we stay on the stage next Saturday as journalist Martin Kettle asks, why do women die in opera? Part of the BBC's opera season, next Saturday at 12:15. For now, from me, good afternoon.
Pedro Trelawney was this with this week's edition of Music Matters. The programme was produced by Jeremy Evans and Ruth Thompson. And there's more from the Aldborough Festival coming up.
This year's Aldborough Festival is once again host to world-class musicians in a stunning lineup of recitals. And Radio 3 will be bringing you some of the highlights in next week's lunchtime concerts. From the rural idyll of Suffolk, performers include Ian Bostridge and Julius Drake, along with pianist Leon Fleischer, joined on Tuesday by his wife, Catherine Jacobson Fleischer, to play three of Dvorak's Slavonic dances. Join me, Penny Gore, for music from the Aldborough Festival 2010, starting in Tuesday's lunchtime concert at 1 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3 is on 90 to 93 FM and on digital radio and also online. Time for the news now from John Shea.
Durham police say they're considering whether to reinvestigate a doctor who was cleared of murdering three patients 5 years ago after comments he's made to a newspaper. Howard Martin has told the Daily Telegraph he killed two patients without their permission because of their dreadful suffering. The General Medical Council struck Dr. Martin off yesterday for giving morphine overdoses to 18 patients. The UN says violence in Afghanistan increased sharply in the first 4 months of this year. A report to the UN Security Council said roadside bombs increased by 94% compared with the same period last year. The report said, on average, there were three suicide bombings a week. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has visited Hiroshima to see how it was rebuilt after the Second World War. Mr. Karzai laid a wreath and spoke to a survivor. Nearly 1.5 million people have left their homes in southern China because of floods. It's thought 90 people have been killed, another 50 are missing. The US Assistant Secretary of State, Robert Blake, has said the humanitarian situation in southern Kyrgyzstan is catastrophic. Mr. Blake is visiting the country after last weekend's ethnic violence. It's thought up to 2,000 people were killed in clashes between the Kyrgyz and Uzbek communities. One of BP's partners has accused the company of gross negligence or willful misconduct over the Gulf of Mexico oil leak. BP denied the claims made by the chief executive of Anadarko Petroleum. Anadarko owns 25% of the well that's leaking. The government has spent almost £18,000 on topping up its wine cellar since the general election. Tom Watson, the MP who obtained the figures, said the cellar, which includes wines from Chateau Latour, Chateau Lafitte and Chateau Margaux, should be sold. The Foreign Office said spending on hospitality is under review. And the weather. It'll be a dry, cloudy day for most of the UK, with some rain in eastern and southern England. Temperatures will be mild, feeling cooler in the north, where there'll be gusty winds. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:03.
And now, the early music show. And as part of the BBC's current opera season, Catherine Bott today explores the last surviving opera by Alessandro Scarlatti.
It's January 1721, and in Rome's Teatro Capranica, a smart and select audience is suitably hushed for the arrival of a conspicuous display of wealth in the person of Prince Francesco Maria Ruspoli, one of the patrons whose generosity and taste has dominated Roman musical life since the beginning of the century. He's always been a particular supporter of the operas of Alessandro Scarlatti, and tonight sees the premiere of Scarlatti's 114th, the tortured tale of a patient wife gracefully submitting to all the unspeakable tests of fidelity that a cruel husband can devise for her, La Griselda. opening sinfonia from Scarlatti's opera La Griselda, with René Jacobs conducting the Akademie für Alte Musik Berlin. Griselda, the subject of today's programme, was composed a full 42 years after Scarlatti's first opera, The Equivoci nel Sembiante, and after that first performance in Rome, it wasn't to receive another until late in the 20th century. Why? Here was a composer who was renowned as perhaps the greatest of his generation, and one who was certainly a major figure in a period of immense change in operatic styles and customs. It wasn't that there was no public for his operas. Scarlatti was brought up in Rome, and not only his later operas like Griselda, but also his earliest ones were composed in that city. Music from Scarlatti's first opera, Gli Equivoci nel Sembiante, in that Radio 3 recording from 1988. Gli Equivoci was first performed in Rome in 1679. It was a huge success, given many performances in the capital and then produced in several other important Italian cities. Queen Christina of Sweden took the young composer under her wing, appointing him her chapel master, and other patrons seem to have almost fought over him. Their rivalry was especially helpful in promoting Scarlatti as an opera composer. The reigning Pope didn't approve of public theatrical spectacles, but Cardinals Ottoboni and Pamphili both happened to have theatres within their own palaces. Very handy. Scarlatti's first half dozen or so operas out of that amazing 114 were all well received in Rome. Scarlatti was enticed away to Naples for 18 years from 1684, where he wrote a further 40 operas, as well as numerous serenatas, oratorios and cantatas. And during that time, he often nipped back to Rome to take charge of performances of his stage works there. Eventually, he seems to have tired of the essential frivolity of the Neapolitan court and went north again in 1702. Why did he think that a return to Rome was a good idea? When he got there, he wrote to yet another patron, Prince Ferdinando de' Medici, "Rome has no shelter for music, which lives here as a beggar." Certainly, Rome had no shelter for public opera. The theatres had been closed since 1700. Despite Scarlatti's high standing in the profession and the continuing loyalty of his Roman patrons, he suffered a bit of a financial meltdown in 1707 and gave Naples another go. This inability to settle was indicative of a crisis in Scarlatti's life. He was middle-aged now and unable, or doggedly unwilling, to assimilate the new, simpler, more accessible style of popular opera that was becoming the rage all over Italy. He suffered disasters with a tragic opera in Venice and an attempt at a comic one in Naples, and returned finally to Rome in 1718 to lick his wounds. Prince Ruspoli would always support him. Recently, I spoke to the conductor Nicholas McGeegan about Scarlatti's last opera, La Griselda. I asked him first, how does Scarlatti rank in the pantheon of Baroque composers?
He is one of those composers, I think, about whom the main thing is known is that they wrote an awful lot of operas, but not many people have actually listened to them, or indeed, until fairly recently, had the possibility to listen to them, let alone look at them in score. Now there are more and more Scarlatti operas, Alessandro Scarlatti operas, published and recorded, and therefore one can see that they are remarkably imaginative and they fit right up there with the great Mr. Handel.
But how had he advanced? I mean, did his operas become more complex through from 1 to 114?
I think.
How did he develop?
Well, a lot of things develop formally, part of which is libretto-driven. But having written 600 cantatas, where you really have the freedom to experiment immediately, to try out different forms of expression, I think that immeasurably deepened his way of writing operas. Because the one thing with cantatas is that people really listen to them. They're written for people, aristocrats, to listen to with glass in hand. Rather few of them who will appreciate the finer points of music, which you can't always guarantee in an opera because people have other things to do and it could be quite noisy. But in a cantatas, he's writing really for connoisseurs. And he can experiment, he can try things out in those, especially emotions.
And those wonderful chromatic recitatives.
Yes.
His recitatives are fabulous.
Well, his early recitatives are almost arias. Very often, you know, there are recitatives that sometimes read like Italian train announcements. They're not, you know, it just says, you know, the train is leaving from platform 3. Ding, ding. But his cantata recitatives are, take every word and paint them. And you really are listening hard to what they, to the finer points of the expression. And the amazing thing with the cantata ones is that sometimes the text was written in the afternoon and he was writing it as it was, well, before the ink was dry. They would actually start off the afternoon with nothing except a blank piece of paper and the poet would be writing and the audience would watch.
Che già mai di chiamarti lasciai.
a recitative from one of Alessandro Scarlatti's chamber cantatas, illustrating Nicholas McGeegan's remarks. What about the recitatives in Griselda? Here's a good example from Act 3. By the way, there'll be more from Nick McGeegan in the programme, including his take on the rather brutal plot of the opera. But for now, what you need to know is that Costanza, daughter of Griselda and Gualtiero, although she doesn't know who her parents are, is in love with Roberto, who is being forced by the exigencies of the plot to abandon her. Result, two broken hearts.
Il tuo cuore è grato al mio, fammi un Roberto.
In that excerpt from the third act of Scarlatti's opera La Griselda, Veronica Cangemi was Costanza, Bernarda Fink Roberto, with Kobe van Rensburg as Roberto's brother, Corrado. René Jacobs conducted the Akademie für Alte Musik Berlin. The opera is quite an intimate tale, quite complex psychologically. There's a lot of dialogue and no spectacle to speak of. All this was in line with Prince Ruspoli's exquisitely refined taste. Indeed, the opera plot, derived originally from a moralistic fable told by the Renaissance poet Boccaccio, was tweaked to suit. I asked Nicholas McGeegan to explain the plot of La Griselda, warning him that I really needed convincing. Well, Alessandro Scarlatti had a quick run of approval and popularity in Berkeley in the mid-90s. You are going to have to go some here because I can't even remember the title, but I found myself taking part in a semi-staged performance of one of Alessandro's operas that had only ever been performed for one night. It was a failure at the time, And I've got to say, I could see why.
It is certainly true that not every Baroque opera is a masterpiece. Either because the music is perfectly awful, but mostly because sometimes the stories are complete rubbish and it's hard to pluck up much enthusiasm for the characters. I have to say that the opera that we're talking about, Griselda, the story is pretty unappetizing.
Well, tell us, give us a quick rundown of the story. It's the patient Griselda, isn't it? She's a put-upon lass.
She is a put-upon lass, and her husband is a marquis of somewhere in Italy. And in order to test her marital fidelity, he subjects her to the most appalling torments and tortures of the sort which in a more civilised society would end him up in jail for spousal abuse. He hides the kids, he tells them they're dead. He just treats her appallingly. And in Zeno's libretto, you feel more than sorry for this woman, but you also feel very angry for the other guy involved, Gualtiero.
Well, does the creation of these operatic characters, Gualtiero, no redeeming features, Griselda, every redeeming feature except that you want to slap her and tell her to, you know, put her finger out, does that give them wonderful vocal opportunities?
Yes, I mean, if you work on the basis that a really good Baroque opera story is remarkably like a really good soap opera story, in other words, you want a lot of events, then the story of the patient Grizzle is certainly a very good one. I mean, if one was being really risque, it would be sort of the sort of life that we who live in the States, who live in the northern states, imagine that people used to live in the South. It has everything that makes for a good episode of Dallas.
Okay, well, I'm beginning to be convinced. It's obviously a lot better than the one I was involved with all those years ago.
But yes,
this is his 114th opera, premiered in 1721. So he'd come a long way.
Yes, and he was born in 1660, which is a very good reason for playing his music this year. And he certainly was a very experienced composer of these operas. And he... what I find extraordinary about the piece is that I can understand it appealing to the male side of the audience in a certain way, in the idea that you keep, I think it's a quote from Handel's Samson, where it is something like, it is God's universal law for man to keep his wife in awe. But you can't imagine that the story has very much appeal to the ladies of the audience, funnily enough. I mean, first of all, unless it's to give them ideas as to how to retaliate against an abusive husband. In other words, I must remember from seeing La Griselda that I shouldn't put up with this.
Quale tu fosti, al tuo principio. Oh,
a scene from the first act of Griselda, in which the entirely unsatisfactory basis of her marriage to Gualtiero is outlined. Dorothea Rushman is Griselda and Lawrence Zazo Gualtiero, with René Jacobs conducting the Akademie für Alte Musik Berlin. So, this isn't a marriage that modern audiences can connect with, but the tale obviously pleased 18th century audiences. In the first half of the century, the story of Griselda was turned into opera by, among others, Bononcini, Albinoni and Vivaldi. Scarlatti himself had done a great deal to help opera plots evolve from the incoherent five actors which prevailed in the 1680s to a more character-driven affair. Well, an affair of more characters, at any rate. In Griselda, for example, the core story of Gualtiero and his patient wife is pumped up, perhaps rather artificially, with the subplot involving their daughter, Costanza, and her love for Roberto, younger brother of Prince Corrado of Apulia. You get the picture. All this, as I've said, was very much tweaked to suit Prince Ruspoli. The result is the alternation of complex recitatives with comparatively simple verse-form arias. Scarlatti's librettist, Apostolo Zeno, whose text was also used by Bononcini, Albinoni and Vivaldi, seems not to have been too perturbed by the extensive rewriting by an unnamed Roman poet for Scarlatti's version. That unnamed Roman poet? Almost certainly Prince Ruspoli himself. He filled the opera with allegory. In this aria from Act II, we learn about Roberto's overwhelming jealousy when he thinks his beloved Costanza loves Gualtiero. Remember that neither of the young lovers know that Gualtiero is Costanza's father. You do not understand the pain of my jealousy. Bernardo Fink as Roberto, with a typical scene-ending aria from Scarlatti's La Griselda. Scarlatti was a grand old man in Rome in 1721. He'd been knighted by the Pope and admitted to the Arcadian Academy, a huge honour for a mere musician to join the likes of his patron, Prince Ruspoli, who was also a member. You'll recall that at the very beginning of the programme I said that Griselda had only one performance. One of the reasons it was never put on anywhere else was that it was very expensive to produce, despite its lack of spectacle, and no other patron or promoter could match Prince Ruspoli's generous funding. Ruspoli was keen to encourage the new generation of castrati. Gualtiero was sung by a big star, Antonio Maria Bernacchi, who will have commanded a big fee. And the role of Costanza was sung by the teenage Giovanni Carestini, making his debut. And in order to give each singer lots of opportunities to make an impression, the opera is long, even by the standards of the day. You begin to see why no one else took it up. More on that in a minute, but let's have a big number to demonstrate how sympathetically Scarlatti wrote for his singers. Here's an aria written for Carestini, Costanza in the Throes of Love. Veronica Cangemi as Costanza in an aria from Scarlatti's Griselda, with René Jacobs conducting the Akademie für Alte Musik Berlin. Incidentally, Jacobs, quoted in the CD booklet, comments on the sparse use of coloratura in La Griselda compared with other operas of the time, but says that when they do occur, they're extremely difficult. To be honest, he says, I think singers cursed Scarlatti. It seems that lots of people, not just singers, found Scarlatti difficult, truculent, and he just wasn't prepared to move with the times. His last operas are not much different in style and structure from the ones he was writing in the 1690s, but they do have a richness and variety of instrumentation, of emotional depth in the arias, for example, that should perhaps have been more appreciated than they were by the opera-going public. Scarlatti played safe with his audiences. Apart from one work, Cambise, all his serious operas after 1716 were intended for performance in Rome, where conservative patrons and audiences were more receptive to his unfashionable style. Nearly 300 years and one early music movement later, La Griselda is hailed by some as his greatest opera. Back to my conversation with Nicholas McGeegan. I suppose that now we're so used to musical theatre having long runs on in the West End and on Broadway. We're used to popular and well-loved operas being revived again and again. In the week we're speaking, there's, you know, last week, another new production of Tosca by Puccini.
Yes.
But we've got to come back to this vexed question of repeat performances for poor old Alessandro. This opera, Griselda, had one performance and then wasn't done again until late in the 20th century.
Yes.
Yet it's hailed by many as his greatest opera, one of the greatest of the time.
Yes, with the triumph, Il Trionfo d'Onore is another one that I love, which is it.
So what makes Griselda plausible to live up to that claim?
One thing is simply it's heartfelt music. She does suffer a lot, very beautifully, I think one must say. And it's also very appreciable on the human level. In other words, it doesn't matter that she's the Marquise de whatever or the Queen of Sicily or whatever. She is a suffering lady, and you feel for her. There aren't too many operas where you'd like to rush onto the stage and give her some advice or give her some help. The suffering wife is a character that, first of all, 50% of the audience could appreciate immediately.
The other 50 can feel guilty.
I was going to say exactly the same thing. There was a wonderful cartoon in The New Yorker back, it must have been about 30 years ago, that somebody showed me, of the end of an opera. And there were all these people lying dead on the stage, and the rest of them all looked as if they had terminal headaches. And one woman in a box turned to the other and said, "You know, with a little early counselling, all this could have been avoided." And one cannot help imagine that this is one of those operas where if she'd only gone to the marriage guidance counsellor before her first aria, he could have saved himself the trouble. Which, of course, is not the point of art, because the point of art in this case is the suffering and the expressive music.
Nicholas McGeegan, our advocate for Scarlatti's last opera, La Griselda. And Griselda really does suffer for three acts, but in true Baroque opera style, her tormentors see the error of their ways and beg for forgiveness in this wonderful quartet towards the end of Act Three.
Oh,
love and fidelity triumphant at the conclusion of La Griselda. That 1721 performance marked the end of an era for Scarlatti. He didn't know that night that Griselda would be his last opera, but he was soon to return one last time to Naples, where he lived in semi-retirement until his death 4 years later. A younger generation of composers and librettists were reinventing opera all over again. Vinci, Pergolesi and Hasse. Just 3 years after Griselda, one Pietro Metastasio appeared on the musical scene to take Zeno's place as leading librettist. It must have grieved Scarlatti that some of his finest operatic writing was so undervalued at the end of his life. He would, I hope, have been gratified to know that his last offering, La Griselda, is so highly valued today.
Final chorus from Scarlatti's Griselda, and it was played in that recording by the Akademie für Alte Musik Berlin, conducted by René Jacobs. And it ends today's Early Music Show, which was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Manchester by Sam Phillips.
This year's Aldeburgh Festival is underway, and Performance on Three is delighted to feature some of the highlights. As one of the event's founders, it's fitting that Benjamin Britten should feature. And next Thursday, the Hebrides Ensemble makes its festival debut, performing his Gemini Variations. Then on Friday, the melodic charm and infectious energy of Dvorak and Wolf are at the heart of a programme perfectly suited to the vibrancy of the Scottish Ensemble. Join me, Martin Handley, for highlights from the Aldeburgh Festival in Performance on 3 next Thursday and Friday at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
And now a second chance to hear last Monday's Radio 3 lunchtime concert. It was introduced by Fiona Talkington.
The German soprano Dorothea Reschmann is here at Wigmore Hall today with the pianist Malcolm Martineau in a programme of romantic beauty, loss and longing. We're going to hear five songs from Mahler's Des Knaben Wunderhorn and Alban Berg's seven early songs. First, though, it's Schubert and three of his songs based on the character Mignon from Goethe's second novel, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, the story of a young man's journey of self-discovery. Mignon is a young girl he rescues from a theatrical troupe, and she becomes devoted to him. The first of the songs, Heiß mich nicht reden, is overflowing with sadness, Mignon vowing to keep her unhappy past a secret. Then, in So lasst mich scheinen, she dresses up as an angel for a children's game. So convincingly, the children think she's a real angel. And then, in Nur wer die Sehnsucht kennt, she reveals her heartache that her beloved Wilhelm has feelings for other women. Only he who knows longing knows what I suffer.
And here now are Dorothea Reschmann and Malcolm Martineau to begin today's lunchtime concert with these three Mignon songs by Schubert.
Schwung.